Good morning. It's 9 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. And you heard Kathleen tell us coming right up, you're going to hear some of the series of economic update with economist Richard Wolff. At 9:30, we'll hear about the International People's Assembly against the banks and against austerity, which is happening in Detroit in early October. The guest is from the Coalition for an International People's Assembly Against the Banks and Against Austerity and the Pan-African Newswire. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, an in-depth update on occupied Palestine with Middle East Children's Alliance co-director Ziad Abbas. We hear a young Palestinian student activist from occupied Hebron, and we'll hear excerpts from the new documentary film Welcome to Hebron. And at 11 on the Recovery Zone, Stephanie Potter hosts a look at the continuing movement for single-payer health care insurance. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can go to our website, which is kboo.fm, and click on Donate Today to become one.
The KBOO Book and Record Sale is back. KBOO's annual book and record sale happens Saturday, September 28th, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Not only will there be fabulous books, CDs, and vinyl to grab at ridiculously low prices, but it will also be a madcap fun community event. There will be KBOO DJs spinning live all day and baked goods available for a donation. All proceeds from the day benefits KBOO, your community radio station. It all happens at the Musicians Union at 325 Northeast 20th on Saturday, September 28th. That's 9 a.m. till 4 p.m. Questions? Contact Ani at volunteer@kboo.org. For more information, check out kboo.fm.
And now here's our economic update with economist Richard Wolff speaking with Sarah Jaffe.
I want now to turn to my guest for today's program and introduce her. So first, let me welcome you to the program, Sarah Jaffe, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
She is a staff writer at the newspaper In These Times and the co-host of Dissent Magazine's Belabored podcast. Belabored is its name. Her writings on labor, social movements, gender, media, and student debt have been published in the following: The Atlantic Magazine, The Nation, The American Prospect, AlterNet, and many other publications. So let's jump right in, Sarah, and let me ask you, as we talked about before, tell us, for those who haven't been paying attention, what's been going on over the last 6 or so months among workers at low-paid retail and fast food outlets across America?
So we're actually about a month and a half away from the first anniversary of the fast food strikes, which was here in New York last November, when workers at a handful of different fast food franchises in the city walked out on a one-day strike. This campaign had been building for a while before that, but that was the first that we've seen of it. In the nearly year since that's happened, we've seen the strike spread to, on August 29th, I believe, 58 cities had workers going on strike in different fast food franchises, different, in some places, retail stores, in a coordinated day of action nationwide. So clearly something has been spreading quickly. So it's a campaign. They're demanding $15 an hour in wages, as you were just talking about. These are companies that, like Walmart, pay an average of $8 or $9 an hour, if you're lucky. And they're also demanding union recognition. So what they're saying, what they want, is the right to form a union without retaliation. They have not officially made a demand or started an organizing campaign toward any particular union, but their demand is, in fact, also for union recognition.
So it's the two key things are $15 an hour,
yep,
and the right to form a union,
yep,
presumably to protect,
right,
the $15 if they got them.
Right, exactly. We know this, and I'm sure your listeners know this pretty well from listening to you, that the law is a great thing. Sure, it's wonderful when we have laws that protect workers, but the best way to actually protect workers is for workers to be organized and aware of their rights and willing to support each other on the job when they're getting screwed.
Okay. Let me then begin with the kinds of questions I know my listeners are interested in.
Right.
Workers in retail jobs, low-level clerks in retail mm-hmm. outlets like Walmart, like fast food workers,
right.
are famous in the United States for decades for getting very low wages,
yep.
at or near the minimum wage,
yeah.
Little, if any, benefits, the usual sad story.
Right.
So tell us the answer to a big question. Why now is there this kind of action over the last year,
yeah.
Growing in many cities, coordinated? What has happened either to these workers or to the larger society that would explain the timing of this?
So there's a few answers to that, right? And I think you divided it well into the larger society and to these workers particularly. What's happened in the larger society, which I'm sure you've talked about before, is that the fastest growing jobs in this country, at the last report I read, I think it was like 70% of the jobs added in the last quarter were low-wage jobs. Mm-hmm. The fastest growing jobs in this country are retail sales clerk, home health care aide, who also make very little money, and that's another topic we could talk about for another hour, and fast food work. So these are the jobs that are coming back, if to whatever degree they were lost, after the recession. It sort of makes sense if you think about it, right? When people don't have a lot of money, they can afford to shop at Walmart, not someplace more expensive. You can afford to go to McDonald's and eat the 99-cent menu and not go to a nicer restaurant where your dinner might cost you $10, $20. And so a lousy economy is in a lot of ways good for these places. That said, they justified those low wages for a long time by saying that these are kids, these are young people, this is, you know, they don't need it. When Walmart began, they often hired women who had never worked outside the home before, so it wasn't their, they weren't the breadwinner of their family, I guess is what I want to say. And so that's how these companies have justified paying low wages for a very long time. Now, it turns out that's not true. The average age of a worker in fast food in this country is 28. For women, it's actually 32. So these are also about two-thirds women work in these jobs, which I think is worth saying. And
yes.
particularly in fast food, the vast majority of them are people of color. So when we're talking about things that haven't changed in a while, right, Walmart has never paid high wages. McDonald's has never paid high wages. But these are larger and larger, the jobs are a larger and larger percentage of the entire workforce. What's happened particularly with these workers is that some people finally put some effort into organizing fast food. And for the same reasons that the low wages are justified by the companies, almost the same reason that a lot of unions were not interested in organizing these populations. Unions have been trying to organize Walmart for a while. The UFCW, who is now behind the Our Walmart campaign, has been trying a variety of strategies.
That's
with
United
Food and Commercial Workers.
Right.
They have been trying a variety of strategies with very little success up until the Our Walmart campaign to organize Walmart. But fast food has mostly been left alone, and that's mostly been because there's a lot of turnover in those industries. They perceived them as being work for kids, and it was perceived very rightly to be very hard to do and probably not worth the effort. So the combination here is that you had somebody who thought they could do it, and you had not much choice, right? Unions are the union density, what we call the measure of how many people are in unions, has been declining rapidly. They really don't have a choice, and so we're seeing unions in many different sectors taking bolder action, being willing to sort of throw money at something that may not succeed. And, you know, in some ways it started out as a Hail Mary. It looks like it's succeeding, although I still don't think anybody knows what the end game is.
All right, well, let's move on right to that difficult question that you opened up. You've been following it. You've been writing about mm-hmm. it. You've been engaged from the beginning
yeah.
Closely with this. Give us as balanced an assessment as you can of what is strong and positive about this movement and its potential.
Right.
And when you're done, I'm going to ask you to be honest with us about what are the problems and the weaknesses so that we have a real sense of this movement, because
yeah.
we're going to go on and talk about what broader impacts it can have. So let's start with what you think is the strength, the momentum, and the potential of this movement of low-paid workers.
So the first thing that was strong about it is that they came out with strikes. They came out with something that takes a lot of effort, a lot of work, a lot of convincing, and a lot of support for workers to be convinced that they can do. And after those first strikes, and after pretty much all the rest of the strikes, they've had a lot of community support. So you would have local clergy members, local members of the city council here in New York and in other places. At the August 29th strikes, they had members of Congress coming out. Jan Schakowsky was out in Chicago with the workers. And they will walk the workers back in the next day after the strike, because one-day strikes are not... they're not designed to shut down production. They're designed to just disrupt things, make a statement, and they are legally protected whether or not workers are actually members of a union. It's protected concerted activity under the National Labor Relations Act. So the first thing is that they took an aggressive step, right? That's great. The second thing, which I already sort of mentioned, is this community support, that these... this movement started here in New York with a group called New York Communities for Change, which is not a union. They've received support from many different unions. They've worked together with many different unions to organize different groups of workers. They helped the United Federation of Teachers organize daycare providers. They've helped the retail, wholesale, and department store union organize grocery store workers and car wash workers. So they've done union organizing, but their real bread and butter is organizing on community issues, on housing, on schools, on the issues that affect New York's low and middle income people. And what actually happened was that they were trying to organize people around housing and realized that you can't fix people's housing problems until they're making a living wage, as you said. And so this really came out of that. They then partnered with the Service Employees International Union, which put in, as we said, a good amount of money and some organizers, and pulled together this campaign, which has now spread. There are different community partners in most different cities, in cities where there isn't a big presence of, where there isn't a community organization like NYCC that has those kind of roots. They're working with either sort of ad hoc committees or Jobs with Justice, which is a labor-backed organization with branches around the country that works on especially low-wage worker issues. And so it's been not a typical union campaign in a lot of good ways, right? That it's rooted in the community, it's rooted in a sense of workers' whole problems, not just their problems on the job, which is a common critique of the way unions have narrowed focus in the years since the New Deal, and especially since World War II. It's doing a lot of things slightly differently. They're not new. Many labor historians have pointed out that before we had the NLRA, before we had the sort of New Deal compromise, this was how you had to organize. You organized in the streets. You organized across the city. And finally, the thing that I think is important is that they're taking aim at the top. They're not trying to get one McDonald's franchise owner who doesn't have much power to agree to a deal. They're trying to get McDonald's at the top to take some responsibility for the wages that their franchisees pay. Because as Stephen Lerner, who's a longtime organizer formerly with SEIU, told me, McDonald's can dictate the diameter of a French fry, but they don't bother dictating what the workers get paid.
Right. So tell me, I've heard, and I'd like a little clarification, mm-hmm. that Walmart and some of the other employers have, in fact, despite the law, retaliated or punished. Tell us a little bit about what the reaction was before we look at the other side.
So the Walmart campaign is something slightly different. As I mentioned, it's backed by the UFCW. They've got an organization called Our Walmart that is a membership organization. The members pay a small amount in dues, and they are not asking for a union at this point. They claim they are an organization that is there to help the workers solve their problems. Several workers at Walmart have been fired. They have gone on repeated strikes. They've made demands that these workers be reinstated. They filed lawsuits, as everybody files against Walmart. I don't remember the number. I was just reading Nelson Lichtenstein's wonderful book about Walmart. And he's got the numbers in there of just how many complaints there had been against Walmart up until, I think, 2009 when his book came out. It's just sort of fantastic and horrifying. The fast food campaign, there have been a few people who have been fired that they, the immediate sort of community support got them reinstated. There have been, I think, I know of one in particular who has been fired who has not been brought back. That was here in New York. Yeah, the, like I said, the biggest problem with enforcing the law is you have to actually make these massive corporations do it. In places like Walmart, it's a heck of a lot cheaper to them to be able to continue paying people poverty wages, to be able to continue keeping people on these schedules that they have no control over, than it is to occasionally pay a fine or have to reinstate somebody if a court 5 years down the line makes them do it. The best way to actually achieve anything in the workplace, as I said, is worker action. And another positive out of this campaign that I should mention is that some of the workers in the fast food campaign, which again, it's backed by a different union, it's run separately, although they're certainly taking tactics from one another, the one-day strikes being the biggest example of that. A few months ago, the end of July, we had a massive heat wave, I'm sure everybody remembers. I was in Chicago at the time, and in Chicago there was a Dunkin' Donuts that had no air conditioning, and you have workers working in 99-degree heat, baking donuts, and they walked out. They went on strike until the air conditioning was fixed. And the same thing happened here in New York at, I believe, a Domino's Pizza. No air conditioning, workers walked out. That kind of thing is actually, to me, more important than the big coordinated strikes, which have been and are starting to be, and we'll talk about, I'm sure you wanted me to yes. give you my critical analysis, have been criticized as a sort of PR campaign. But these small empowered strikes within the workplace, those give me all the hope, because those are workers figuring out that they can make demands and they can act on their own and they don't need anybody from above telling them how and when to do it. They can do it because they've realized that they're not afraid anymore.
This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update, and I'm speaking with Sarah Jaffe of In These Times, Dissent, The Nation, a writer, about this topic for today, which is the movement of low-paid workers in the United States. We talked about the strength and the potential. Tell us what you think, as a close observer of all of these actions. Yeah. What are the problems? What are the weaknesses? What are the things that have to be dealt with if the potential is going to be realized?
Yeah. So I talked about the labor community partnerships that are at the core of where the fast food campaign has come from. In theory, with that, you can get the best of both worlds. You can get skilled labor organizers who've been doing this for years, who really know how to run a union campaign, who are helping skilled community organizers who actually have a base and some trust in that city, in that community, working together to really organize the workers and the community around this issue. You can also get the worst of both worlds, which is a union that is based far away, calling all the shots and holding the purse strings, and community organizers who don't really have the capacity to finish the job. And so there's a lot of concern about that. There's a lot of concern that in trying to organize a nationwide day of action or a nationwide movement, that it in turn jeopardizes individual processes happening at different stores. That, you know, if you call a strike for one particular day, August 29th, say, that, and you're struggling to get a few more workers in one store to go out, but they're not quite ready on August 29th, and then something bad happens on August 29th, that you lose the potential of having more people go out, because these are really tenuous, difficult things to do, right? Convincing somebody to risk their job
is always
even
serious.
If it's technically illegal for them to risk their job. I mean, you don't, yeah, right, you don't work at McDonald's if you don't need the money, right? These are not the labor of love kind of jobs that, you know, people are working there because they need to feed their families. And so there's a lot of questions that are very much worth asking about who's actually in control, who's actually making the decisions. The campaign stresses that the workers are making the decisions. And as I mentioned, the autonomous actions that we've seen workers taking are encouraging.
like I said, more so to me than seeing a national coordinated action, although that too is impressive. Also impressive is that they say that some of these 58 cities that were involved on August 29th were because workers heard about the other strikes and wanted to get involved and reached out. But the real question at the core of, I think, any organizing campaign, any union campaign, any existing union, is who's in charge, who's making the decisions, and who is it building worker power? There has been a lot of criticism that these strikes are just a PR strategy, that they're building to either pass a political goal, a national minimum wage, some state or local minimum wage increases. New York here passed a minimum wage increase last year, which a lot of New York politics observers who doubted Andrew Cuomo wanted to pass such a thing credit to both Occupy and the fast food movement that there's a lot of pressure now to pay attention to economic issues. That's a real possibility. Josh Idelson interviewed Mary Kay Henry, the president of the SEIU, recently, and you know, she did say that possibly, you know, state legislation, things like that, could be a goal. Another goal they discussed was the possibility of a deal of some sort with one or more of these fast food franchises that would allow them to organize some, not others, something like that. These are certainly concerns. These are things that SEIU has been criticized for doing in the past, making deals with it's like nursing home companies or various other bosses to organize some workers in order to actually just get more workers into the union. And they agree, either they agree not to strike or they agree not to try to organize in different places. And they'll make these deals for a certain amount of time. And so there's a lot of debate within organized labor about the value of this kind of deal making. Some people will argue that you get the important thing now is to raise that union density number to get more workers into unions so that you can then have more power as a union. Others will say that this is not any better than the sort of, you know, state-controlled unions that you see in China. They're really not consistent, or they're really not there to raise worker power. For me, the question is always, what do the workers think? I've talked to a lot of workers within this campaign, a lot of whom feel like this is something amazing, some of whom have had union jobs before that are like, yeah, I want a union job again. That was much better than this that I have now. Some who are a little critical of the way SEIU has handled some organizing, but also see that this is helping them to build their own power in their stores. And a lot of workers who say that they've gotten small raises. Certainly nobody's making $15 an hour yet. But we've seen workers get raises. We've seen, my favorite story is this young woman, Pamela Flood, who was working to fast food job, and I believe at Walgreens, told me after she went on strike, her boss started calling her Miss Flood again instead of calling her by her first name. Like I said, the biggest problem is that we don't know what the end game is. That also could be the biggest possibility, right? When you teach people how to organize, when you help people realize their own power, that's not something you can easily stuff back in a box.
No, and the question I want to ask.
Yeah.
It's one thing to deal with, and these are old problems of organizing.
Oh, yeah.
As I listen to you, they're classic. They
right.
were there, those debates that you just outlined were there 10 and 20 and 40 and 60 and 100 years
yeah.
ago. But here's another one.
Yeah.
Just like you might want a union to protect a wage increase you got,
right.
you might want to reorganize the enterprise to protect everything you've got. In other words, if a union or even just a group of workers mm-hmm. negotiate a better wage, if they negotiate air conditioners when it's too hot or heating when it's too cold, everything they negotiate can, and we now know,
right.
will be withdrawn
right.
the first chance the boss gets.
Yep.
The way to avoid that happening would be if the workers themselves became the bosses, if they if the open-endedness you describe of where this can all go might begin to teach the workers that if they ran the enterprise themselves, the way workers' co-ops do, the way the workers in Argentina when they took over because the capitalists left, when workers take over, in a sense, that's the best security they can get.
Sure.
It's the top of the line for what a union might want. Is any of that floating around the air among the workers that are beginning to move that you encounter?
So I have not heard any of this talk, certainly from workers right now at McDonald's or whatever. You certainly hear this conversation happening a lot these days. Your book, some other people who are really talking about the power of co-ops. We saw the Republic Windows and Doors fight years ago sort of end up with that strategy. It'd be really interesting to see if you wanted to like form a workers' co-op and own a McDonald's franchise, what the corporation at the top would do, right? Because the structure of these particular businesses would make it quite difficult. Because, again, we're talking about a company that's, like, dictating the size and shape of your French fries. I would imagine that they would not be too thrilled with a group of McDonald's workers wanting to run the store, because that would make news, and then you'd have other people wanting it. Oh, goodness. But that said, again, we don't know where things will go. We don't know what some people who get involved in this campaign might learn, might experiment with. I would not say that that has been part of any discussions right now. And I think, I mean, a lot of big unions have been wary of the idea of, you know, advocating workers' co-ops. Because we've been in this defensive position for so long that anything that sounds like the C word, communism, really scares the heck out of, well, everyone still. Well, not everybody. My generation is not really afraid of it at all.
You've stressed the relationship between workers, labor unions, and community and community organizations in shaping and building this movement of low-paid workers. Is it a coincidence, or what is the relationship between that and the recently concluded National AFL-CIO Convention, which was widely reported in the press as being all about unions opening up to an alliance or to cooperation with community organizations. Is there a relationship? How do you see all of this happening from your vantage point of in the trenches working with the fight at the low-income situation?
So, I mean, SEIU is not a member of the AFL-CIO. They're part of the smaller federation, Change to Win, that has been backing the fast food movement. The UFCW, actually, another big bit of news is that they just recently rejoined the AFL-CIO after having been part of Change to Win, that they are behind the Our Walmart campaign. So, like, the direct connections are
mixed.
Right. But what actually is happening is that, you know, labor realizes that we're down to 7% private sector union density, and that's not sustainable. That's dying. And
just so everyone knows, this word density, in case you're not familiar, it basically means that something under 7% of private sector workers in the United States are members of or represented by a union. Yep. 93%+ of workers working for a private employer have no union.
Right.
So that's the reality.
Right. And so with that being the reality, with labor having less and less sway politically and in sort of the hearts and minds, as we would say in military terms, that they know that they need to be working with people who have maybe a different base. With community organizations like NYCC, like the group that is Group Arise Chicago that's working with the fast food workers there, the power dynamic between them and the labor unions is usually that labor has the purse strings. The unions control the money and are funding these community groups. And so that's where power goes. The sort of alliances with big left organizations, the Sierra Club is the one that keeps getting thrown out there because some of the unions that are, for instance, looking for jobs on the Keystone XL pipeline are wary of alliances with environmental groups that they think don't care about workers' issues right. enough. And I think that's a fair concern. It is also a fair concern that unions should not be so short-sighted when they're pursuing jobs, that they should be pursuing jobs that, you know, perhaps are slightly more sustainable. But I understand, right, that you need to eat and you need that job and you don't want some, you know, relatively wealthy person from the Sierra Club telling you that you can't have your job because right. of something that, you know, the environmental groups have not been very good at all at selling environmental issues as workers' issues, as things that actually affect you in your backyard, even though we know that that is actually very true. The power dynamic in those places, right, is that most of these other left organizations are funded not by member dues, which is, you know, unions are funded by workers. There are real questions to be had about how democratic that, or how much control the workers have over where that money is spent. But unions are funded by workers who pay dues, who do extra political contributions. Whereas the other groups are funded by wealthy donors. And, you know, some of the most quote-unquote liberal, wealthy, whatever types who are the, you know, donors of all to all sorts of different organizations are not particularly concerned with whether somebody making $8 an hour gets a raise. And so there are real questions about who will have power, how much control you want to give anybody, who's going to be giving up things. And, I mean, for me, I want to see a much more real conversation being had about unions' relationship with the Democratic Party and whether that continues to be a useful thing or is sort of a one-sided abusive relationship like it has been in recent years. Whether that is a continually useful strategy of pumping money into sort of national elections. Another interesting thing that has come out recently out of these changes at the AFL-CIO is that they're talking about investing money in state politics. They're talking about Texas, for instance. And would it be much more useful for unions to get involved in local races on a state level where you can sort of seed the party coming up or seed politics coming up? It doesn't have to be the Democratic Party. We've got a wonderful politician here in New York City running for public advocate who ran on the Working Families Party ticket the first time. With progressive, pro-union, pro-worker people who actually understand what it's like to work for low wages and struggle. So there's a lot of questions still out there, obviously, for labor, where it's going to go, who it's going to partner with. And as always, the question that I always, always come back to is who's going to actually be in control?
Thank you very much, Sarah Jaffe, for joining us. I think the most important thing that I get from what you've said is that there is genuine movement and that it has great potential, but it confronts the real legacy and history of the labor movement and its problems. Those will not be easily solved, but it's a lot better to see things happening than what we have had before.
And that was from Economic Update with economist Richard Wolff. Coming up next, we're going to hear about the International People's Assembly against banks and against austerity. And you do have it tuned to your community radio station, KBOO in Portland.
Good morning. This is Kathleen Stevenson for Political Perspectives. And on the line with me from Detroit is Abayomi Azikiwe. He is a Detroit organizer of the Workers' World Party and editor of the Pan-African Newswire. He is part of the International People's Assembly Against the Banks and Against Austerity, which is coming up in Detroit in early October, during the anniversary of the federal $700 billion bank bailout. Mr. Azikiwe, welcome to KBOO. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
K- Can you tell us about this event, first of all, in the interview, about the International People's Assembly against the banks and against austerity?
Well, it's an idea that we came up with several months ago in light of the upcoming fifth anniversary of the massive bank bailout of the system here in the United States, and indeed the world economic system. In 2008, there was a serious global crisis, which continues through this time period, where governments and other entities, including the Federal Reserve Bank here in the United States, as well as central banks throughout Europe, supplied trillions upon trillions of dollars in liquidity and other incentives to shore a system that was badly broken. We've had the bailout of the banks, some of the large insurance companies. We saw here in the city of Detroit 4 years ago the bailout and restructuring of two of the big three auto companies, i.e. Chrysler and General Motors. And in the city of Detroit, the people who have, in fact, made the auto industry what it is over the last 7 to 8 decades are in a situation right now, through no fault of their own, where, in fact, they need assistance, and they also need to get the banks and the financial institutions and the multinational corporations off the backs of the people of this city. Many of the news reports that we've been subjected to, not only here in the city of Detroit, but throughout the United States and around the world, are claiming that the city of Detroit filed bankruptcy in July. But this is a total distortion of what is actually going on. The people in the city of Detroit had absolutely no influence or control over this whole process. It was something that was imposed by the multi-million-dollar governor, Rick Snyder, who appointed an emergency manager, Kevin Orr, who in fact was involved in the Chrysler bankruptcy and restructuring. So we want to present an alternative narrative to what the corporate media is saying about the conditions in the city of Detroit, and to rally and mobilize people to fight against this bankruptcy. Because what's behind this bankruptcy is the plot to bust the unions, to steal large portions of the public pension funds, to seize and sell off city assets, and also to downsize city services. So this is the objective of the event. So far, we have over 280 endorsements by individuals as well as organizations. And this is coming up on October 5th and 6th. It's going to be in downtown in Grand Circus Park. So that's a general overview of why we're doing this assembly.
Right. And a little bit more about Detroit. Do you want to present some of that alternative narrative about what you see the situation in Detroit as being, and what you would like to have out there about what should be happening, and or what is happening and what should be happening, as opposed to the bankruptcy that was filed?
Yes. The city of Detroit, the financial problems that we face here are part and parcel and a reflection of the overall economic crisis that's been developing inside the United States, going all the way back, really, to the 1950s, when we started having downsizing in industry. This was something that impacted Detroit as early as the late 1950s. Of course, with the military-industrial complex and the extension of the credit system inside the United States, it has delayed the crisis from becoming even more severe. But now the United States is facing a situation where they have to make a decision over whether to maintain the rising rates of profitability for the banks, or whether they're going to address the needs of the people who are being driven deeper and deeper into poverty and joblessness. We see that there has been, over the last 5 years, large numbers of people who have been thrown in the unemployed on the unemployment rolls. Many people are working part-time and want to work full-time. Many people have completely dropped out of the labor force. And this is why we get this distorted statistics in relationship to the actual jobless rate. Now, since the 1950s in the city of Detroit, 20 years after that, in the 1970s, there was another major recession, in part brought on by further deindustrialization, but also the oil shocks that took place during the mid-1970s. This, of course, destroyed tens of thousands of additional industrial jobs in the city. Then the latest wave came during the late 1990s and the early 2000s. But even prior to that, there was, during the mid-1980s, General Motors and the other leading auto companies had a conscious plan to eliminate literally hundreds of thousands of jobs from the industry. A lot of those jobs were sent to other parts of the United States. A lot of them were eliminated due to automation and the advancement of technology. Other jobs were sent offshore. So when this happens, it drives down the tax base of the city. And when the tax base is driven down, that means you have to cut city services, you have to raise taxes, and if that's not adequate, then of course you have to borrow money. And who do you borrow money from? You borrow money from the same banks, the same financial institutions that have been involved in these nefarious plans to outsource and downsize the economy and drive down wages and to cripple organized labor. Now, the final onslaught that's going on right now, to a great degree, stems from the predatory mortgage mess that developed starting in the late 1990s, but extending to the first decade of the this century, where African American communities and Latino communities were targeted for these toxic predatory loans. And as a result of that, in Detroit, we've had over 100,000 foreclosures in the city over the last 6 years. And this has really created a monumental shortfall of public resources. And the way in which the city administration has responded to this is to borrow more money, to refinance existing debt. And, of course, this is unsustainable. And in 2011, when Governor Rick Snyder was elected to office, he's a right-wing Republican who said he was going to remake the state of Michigan, because Michigan had lost 1 million jobs between 2000 and 2010 when he was elected. He passed, with the Republican-dominated legislature, a series of draconian bills, one of which was Public Act 4, which said that if a city was in financial distress, that the mayor, the city council, or the school board, or the superintendent could be, in effect, suspended or have their power nullified, and the governor could appoint a so-called emergency manager. And this emergency manager would come in and make the, quote, difficult, unquote, decisions that the elected officials apparently were not able to make. And, of course, all these decisions negatively impact working people in the city of Detroit. And the city of Detroit is just one among many other cities throughout the state, most of whom are majority African-American municipalities who have had emergency managers appointed over the city as well as over the school districts. So we're trying to articulate a position that it is not the fault of the unions, the pensioners, the people who reside here in the city of Detroit, that the city of Detroit is in this crisis. It's the direct result of the predatory policies of the banks and the financial institutions and the multinational corporations, and that the only real solution to this crisis is the cancellation of the bank debt, so the city will have enough money to pay their workers, to maintain the pensions, and also maintain control of the city assets.
I'm speaking with Abuyomi Azikwe. He is a Detroit organizer with the Workers' World Party and editor of Pan-African Newswire, and he is also part of the International People's Assembly Against the Banks and Against Austerity, happening October 5th and 6th in Detroit. And I'm looking at a flyer for the event, Mr. Azikwe, and I see some of the demands, including something that you just mentioned, canceling the debt. What other demands is this group of people putting forth?
Well, we want the jobs of workers and the pensions of retirees and the public services to be maintained. We want the emergency manager, along with the governor, to back off the union-busting activity that's been going on in the city now for several years. We want a total repeal of the undemocratic and racist emergency management of the city and of the schools. And what's interesting about this whole emergency management process is that in 2012, people circulated a petition which gathered over 220,000 signatures to place the issue of emergency management on the statewide ballot. And the governor and his supporters fought it very, very hard. Petitions, first of all, they tried to say that they weren't printed in the right font. They couldn't challenge the actual signatures, but they said that the petitions weren't printed in the right font. So this went to court. Decision was made that that was a secondary issue, that the petitions were in compliance. Then they appealed it to the state appeals court, which could not find a mechanism to keep it off the ballot. And they appealed it to the state Supreme Court, which refused to hear the case. So it did appear on the ballot in November of 2012. And interestingly enough, despite the fact that the governor and the people who support emergency management spent millions of dollars in advertising and other types of propaganda through the local newspapers and the television stations, that bill, Public Act 4, which had mandated emergency management for any city that's designated as being in financial distress, the people overwhelmingly throughout the state of Michigan voted it down. But, however, what happened the next month, in December of 2012, the governor, along with the state legislature, drafted a new law, in effect, nullifying the vote of millions of people in the state of Michigan against emergency management. Also what they did, they passed a right-to-work law in the state of Michigan. So now Michigan is a right-to-work state. They also passed laws that eliminated the so-called personal property tax for businesses. So all of these laws are putting these cities in deep financial crises. They've already done it with the school districts through the introduction of charter schools and other forms of privatization. The Detroit Public Schools has been under emergency management now for over 4 years. There are other school districts throughout the state that are under emergency management. And the appointment of these emergency managers have done nothing except drive the cities and the school districts deeper into debt because they have no plan for recorrecting the problems that exist. In Detroit now, even in light of this bankruptcy, which is in federal court right now, the only proposal that the emergency manager is advancing is floating more bonds. In other words, they just want to refinance the existing debt, which they claim is $22 billion. But we're disputing that from the standpoint that it was the banks that were responsible for the housing crisis. Also, it was the banks that were responsible for these interest swaps and credit default swaps, which they hoodwinked the city leadership into accepting over the last 8 years. Fixing the city into high interest rates of 6 or above 6% a fixed rate, when in fact the rate has dropped now under 1%, the overall lending rate in the United States. So all of that money is pure profit for the banks. And we were able to get through a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit over 3,000 pages of documents which outline these bond issues, these loans, and the fact that the city of Detroit is strapped with massive amounts of debt that, of course, result from the what we consider criminal activity of these financial institutions. So we've been out at all of the major bankruptcy hearings since August, picketing, Just this last past Thursday, there was objection hearings. Over 110 people who were residents of the city filed objections against the bankruptcy. And there was a day-long hearing where the judge had to listen to the people of the city, retirees, union members, residents, professionals, all came forward with written statements, placing blame not on themselves, but on the banks, on the corporations, and the politicians who have, in essence, driven this city into financial distress. So we're going to continue these activities. The October 5th and 6th International People's Assembly is also designed to build broader support against these bankruptcy hearings. On October 23rd, there's going to be a very important hearing where the judge will hear arguments related to the constitutionality of the bankruptcy filing, because there were numerous violations that have taken place in this whole process. One of which is that the state constitution says that pensions cannot be tampered with in the state of Michigan. And the emergency manager through the governor, that's one of the main aims of this whole process, is to seize the pension funds, which amount to anywhere between $5 and $6 billion, and possibly cut the monthly pensions to retirees, some of which are people who have no other income. Some are in their 90s, some are over 100 years old, some are widows, retired civil servants, firefighters, police officers, chemists, sanitation workers, and so forth. And we think this is completely unjust, that if there's any cuts to be made, it should be made to the profits and the fees and the penalties that the banks say they are entitled to, mm-hmm. and that the pensions and the city assets and the wages and the collective bargaining rights of the workers should be maintained.
And what would it take to cancel the debt to the banks? How could that happen?
Well, it could happen through the municipal leaders. It could happen through a process where the people refuse to go along with these activities. We are not going to accept, for example, the selling off of the assets of the Detroit Institute of Arts. We're talking about billions upon billions of dollars of art. And the leadership at the Detroit Institute of Arts, as well as people in the community, are saying that under no circumstances should this art be sold. We have one of the largest public parks in the country, Belle Isle. And they're talking about breaking off this island, which is between the city of Detroit and Windsor, Canada, across the Detroit River. They're talking about setting it up as somewhat of an autonomous city-state, in a way, where developers would come in to build condominiums or shopping malls or whatever, and none of that revenue would be channeled back into the city of Detroit. They also have a plan to privatize public lighting. Detroit has a public lighting system that is in deep distress, and they're talking about turning over the public lighting system to the private utility companies, DTE Energy. Mm-hmm. So the debts could be canceled through actions by the officials, or they could be canceled through actions by the federal bankruptcy court. If the debts are considered illegitimate, if the practices of the banks were illegal, and of course there have been many investigations and reports and penalties and even criminal charges that have been filed against some of the leading banks in the United States, which holds debt that they claim is owed by the city of Detroit. So this is what we're calling for. We feel that this $22 billion is not a legitimate figure, and that it directly derives, comes from the absolute criminal activities of these banks and these financial institutions and bond insurers, and that it should be struck down, and that people's pensions, which are guaranteed by the state constitution, and other city assets should be maintained. And those who created the crisis are the ones who should pay for it.
And Mr. Ezekwe, we have just a couple minutes left, but why should people in other cities, Portland in our case, why should they care about what's happening in Detroit?
Because if the banks and the multi-million dollar politicians and their supporters are allowed to put the city of Detroit into bankruptcy illegally in an effort to bust the municipal union, to rob the pension funds, and to sell off city assets, and to nullify the fundamental democratic rights of people to vote. This will set a dangerous precedent, which will, in fact, spread to other cities around the country. And we also see this as being an international problem. If we look at see what's going on in Greece, in Spain, in Portugal, in Italy, and even in France and Britain, there have been massive cuts in public services. In Greece, they've even cut pensioners' benefits. In Cyprus, we saw earlier this year where they attempted to place a 10% tax on all savings accounts inside the country, which effectively shut down the banking system for several days because they feared a run on the banks. All of this is being done because we're under a system that is, in a way, in terminal crisis. They have no solution to the problems of poverty and unemployment. They have no solution other than austerity and political repression. So we feel very strongly it is our job to articulate and to organize and mobilize a different narrative and a different political program, because all cities throughout the United States are facing a similar crisis. In Illinois, they're saying that their pension system is one of the worst funded in the country. And we've seen the bankruptcies in Stockton, California, in San Bernardino, in Vallejo, cities like Providence, Rhode Island, and Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Jefferson County, Alabama, are also under deep distress and are facing bankruptcy, and some are already in bankruptcy. So we think that if the people of these cities, if the unions of these cities, school teachers and community organizers don't stand up and fight this, it's going to be the reality for hundreds of millions of people inside the United States, and indeed billions around the world.
I want to thank you very much, Abayomi Ezekwe. Thank you so much for speaking with us today about this and about
thank you so much for having us on, and you can go to our website at internationalpeoplesassembly.org.
Great. Okay. Thanks again, and let me tell you that you've been listening to Abayomi Ezekwe. He is a Detroit organizer of the Workers World Party, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, the International People's Assembly Against the Banks and Against Austerity, happening October 5th and 6th in Detroit, Michigan, and you can go to their website, as he said, internationalpeoplesassembly.org. This is Kathleen Stevenson for Political Perspectives. I want to make one announcement. Ashley Sanders, a Salt Lake-based activist, will speak on organizing to end corporate rule and get money out of politics. This will be happening at the Clark County Public Utilities Community Room on the corner of Mill Plain and Fort Vancouver Way in Vancouver, Washington, at 7 p.m. tomorrow, Thursday, the 26th. And stay tuned for Air Cascadia with Chris Andre, followed by The Recovery Zone with Stephanie Potter. Thank you.
And it is 10 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland, and coming right up will be Air Cascadia, followed by Flashpoints. And then at 11, we'll hear the Recovery Zone. So do stay tuned to your community radio station.
At KBOO, we have a dynamic community of 500 volunteers doing everything from front desk work, janitorial work, community reporting, hosting information booths, clerical support, news writing, documentary making, engineering live music, operating soundboards, working in the music library, and many, many other things. KBOO absolutely depends on volunteers to carry out the work of the station. We are always looking for new volunteers. We have monthly volunteer orientations, which is the first step in getting involved. Contact KBOO Volunteer Coordinator Annie Haynes about the next volunteer orientation at 503-231-8032 extension 231 or at volunteer@kboo.org.